Seeking Delphi, episode number 17, Ethics in Artificial Intelligence and Autonomous Systems. I'm Mark Sackler. The future lives here. When it comes to technology, no subject is hotter these days than artificial intelligence. Will it reliably navigate our cars? Will it take most of our jobs? Will it take over and annihilate us altogether? Hardly a day goes by without some such topic in the news. But the real question is, what, if anything, is being done to address the myriad of issues around a future world that may be dominated by these systems? One major organization that's addressing it is IEEE. It's the world's largest technology organization, and it's examining many of these questions and laying down guidelines which they hope will steer humanity in the right direction. They're doing this with something they call the Global Initiative for Ethics in Artificial Intelligence and Autonomous Systems. To find out more about this, I put in a call to John C. Havens. Besides being the executive director of the initiative, he's the author of two books, most recently, Artificial Intelligence, which deals with these ethical issues surrounding artificial intelligence. He also was a panelist at the recent Emotion AI Summit, which I covered in a previous program. Let's hear what he had to say. John, welcome to Seeking Delphi, and thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me.
John, if you could start out by giving us a little background on yourself. Who is John C. Havens, and how does that tie into both your book, Artificial Intelligence, and the IEEE Initiative?
Sure, and thanks for asking. I went to New York City after college to be an actor, and I sort of fell into writing because I would write some scripts when I wasn't acting in them. And that kind of got me into the business realm, where I ended up being an EVP of a top 10 PR firm. And then I became really fascinated with aspects of well-being in the sense of both physiological health and well-being, but also the economics of well-being, meaning actual indicators about people's well-being, like gross national happiness, etc. And I also began writing for places like The Guardian and Mashable and wrote two books. The first was called Hacking Happiness, about the intersection of technology and well-being. And the more recent one was called Artificial Intelligence. And I actually spoke at South by Southwest about that book, and some wonderful people from IEEE were there. One of the things the book talks about is how to create a code of ethics for AI. And I ended up actually pitching that idea to IEEE because I'm a consultant with them. And thankfully, there were some wonderful people at IEEE already thinking about doing that. So now I have the deep pleasure and honor to be running program. I should say I'm executive director and we have a chair, but I'm one of the people in leadership running the initiative.
The IEEE Global Initiative for Ethical Considerations in Artificial Intelligence and Autonomous Systems. That's quite a mouthful, John. Could you tell us what that's all about? What is the mission? And for that matter, what is IEEE?
Sure. So IEEE is the world's largest technology organization. It's got over 500,000 members in 160 countries, and their tagline is advancing technology for the benefit of humanity. And the IEEE Global Initiative, which I'm the executive director for, we have two primary things we do. We have a paper called Ethically Aligned Design. The second draft comes out in December of 2017. And then we provide recommendations for standards that are aligned with the idea of ethics and technology. So we have 11 standards that we've created based on, or I should say that we've inspired, created based on the ethically aligned design. The mission is actually to empower and to train any technologist. And by technologist, we don't just mean, say, like an engineer or programmer. We also mean policymakers, academics, marketers, to prioritize applied ethics or values-based design considerations in the actual design phase of their work. And the reason for that is, you know, codes of ethics people have had for centuries, you know, however long. But with the especially challenges to human agency and emotion that take place with autonomous and intelligent systems, there's a deeper level of due diligence needed, not just to deal with risk and compliance. And that's sort of what people are used to say about ethics in the, especially in the corporate arena. but is to say when you actually get to understand more deeply what people's values are and also how they feel about these technologies, it means you build better and smarter products, services, and systems for them.
So the next logical step here, John, is to look at some of the individual issues. And obviously the biggest one, the one that gets all the news lately, is the potential for massive job loss to artificial intelligence and autonomous systems. There's a lot of scaremongering out there. There are forecasts that as many as 30, 40, even 50% of all current jobs will be taken over by autonomous systems in the next few decades. So how do we deal with that? How real is the problem? What's the position of John Havens and of IEEE?
Sure. And I mean, obviously, you know, these are my responses as John, but I will also be speaking in terms of the sense of the work we're doing at IEEE. But one key thing, and I mentioned the well-being indicators or metrics in my introduction, the more you get to know measures of prosperity, and the main one that the world is used to is the GDP, gross domestic product. It may sound strange to your question, how are these, you know, technologies going to affect jobs? But you really have to understand the nature of why people kind of build anything, right? And this is not about AI. And I also want to be crystal clear, this is not about demonizing business or technology or AI in general. It's about, you know, we're asking these really tough questions about humanity in general, right? Will I be replaced in my job? Will I, you know, will consciousness be able someday to maybe be imbued in a machine? Well, the bigger question that I'd like people to consider is GDP, which is a metric that was galvanized in 1944 at the Bretton Woods Conference, created about 10 years earlier by a guy named Simon Kuznets, was originally designed in the States when FDR was trying to find a good way to understand what, I should say, Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the States was, the president was trying to understand what, you know, say, tanks and planes they had to build for the war. So that it was really initially an assessment system to understand how the president could both keep the people who were staying in America, not going off to war, fed and clothed, while they could also build, you know, the necessary munitions, et cetera, to take care of the soldiers. So what happened is that accounting system became an incredibly powerful tool, understandably. But what happened is also, I think it's like it went from 4%, the GDP in 1940 went from 4% to, I think it was like 38% in 4 years. And what that meant is people were like, wait a second, it's not like magically just having a number or a statistical accounting system can make more things happen. But what it does do is it says what we want to measure and what we want to build is also what we'll prioritize. So all that, to go back to your answer about robots and systems and AI, you know, and our jobs, GDP is not about just measuring financial measures like what did you sell last year. It also prioritizes, emphasizes, or influences exponential growth. And this is also what, say, shareholder focus is often about, which is not, I want to invest in a company so they give me back the dollar that I gave them and an extra 10 cents every year. Understandably, they want as much of an investment over and above exponentially they can get. It's not that, again, I want to be clear, it's not bad or evil, but exponential growth from the way that you count something then deeply influences, in the case of jobs, what technologies are going to be built, not just to take people's jobs. You know, no one that I know is like, yay, I can take people's jobs away, keep their friends and jobs. So just to wrap this up in a sort of more succinct way of answering this, right now today, a CEO, when she goes into her shareholder meeting, it's not fair to ask her to say, hey, because your shareholders are demanding exponential returns, you should go in there and not honor that and really say, well, we have to keep all these jobs. People don't want to take people's jobs away, but you can't do two things. You can't serve two masters in one sense. You can't say, let's prioritize exponential growth, because then what that means is at some point, the tough decisions about where, you know, what are we going to, either have to make money or cut expenses. Humans are going to be one of the easiest ways to cut expenses in the next 5 to 10 years, because you build a system, you pay a one-time fee of paying the system, maybe there's some minor maintenance fees, but then based on the vertical, and there are dozens and dozens where, you know, machine learning and AI is, you know, doing amazing things. But what are you going to tell someone? I interviewed a guy who was a lawyer who had bought a AI system. It's probably a lot cheaper now, for like $500,000. And he was able to fire 10 people. He was paying $50,000 or whatever. And so right away it was a wash. And he said, look, you know, John, it's not that I want to fire these people, but the machine learning, you know, these 10 paralegals or whatever it was, going through dozens and dozens and dozens, hundreds even of books, looking for case files where they could find like one or two words even that would relate to a case file. It would take two human beings sometimes 48 hours to look through the right cases. You know, this system, whatever it was, the machine learning, can do the same work of those two people in about 2 hours. So it's impossible. It's not fair to say to someone, here's this system over here, this beautiful new technology that can, you know, increase your efficiency and productivity by 40 or 50%. And it's going to maybe be a one-time fee, but then you drop all these other fees, which include you're not going to keep people around to do the work that this machine can do better. And in the same breath say, hey, you guys should be creating more jobs. This is a societal issue. Yes, businesses would need to say, well, we'll adopt triple bottom line versus single bottom line economics. But that's why the other discussions, which are, you know, there's some wonderful reports from different people, both in the UK and the States, about which verticals may lose jobs when. But to me, that's semantics, because there's no law that I know of yet in any country, except for maybe some things with gene editing, where anyone is saying universally, hey, these verticals that are focusing on AI, stop building that stuff because of jobs. You won't hear that. What you will hear is, don't hinder innovation. And what that means is there's no reason, at least for me, logically and empirically, to think that there's any reason for anyone creating any technology that could replicate human skills to stop until society says, well, hold on a second. Do we want people to have purposeful work where they might have jobs? And do we want to also prioritize the environment? In that case, triple bottom line economics is something the business world invented. That's what we need to shift to, or people will lose jobs. That's it.
So how do we deal with it if all those jobs are lost? I mean, I hear a lot about UBI, or universal basic income, and I have to admit, I'm a bit of a skeptic on how that could possibly work out, at least in the short term. Most of the pilot programs I've heard of are for stipends that are really little more than subsistence level, hardly a recipe for well-being. So what's your recipe for dealing with it?
Well, first off, I want to give a shout out to a person who is the most expert in the area of UBI that I know. It's a guy named Scott Santens, S-A-N-T-E-N-S. So if you Mark, or your listeners, go online to Twitter, and I think it's at Scott Santens. He's just brilliant. And he knows from a global perspective where UBI different projects or programs have worked very well. I think sometimes, like in especially places like not in the States, like Brazil, I think in Africa. And I think what's interesting, and he would say this better because I don't have a deep expertise, it is hard for me as an American to think UBI will work. And that's not just to speak about the current administration. It's there's a sort of attitude that if you get something that could be sort of synonymous with welfare, that it's a handout, right? That, again, whether one's a Republican or a Democrat. Whereas if you go to Europe, you know, and you talk to, as I'm sure many of your listeners have a lot of friends in Europe, when, for instance, your healthcare is taken care of and it's not considered a handout, it's just the government pays for healthcare. You know, a lot of people would use the UBI money they got in the States to pay for their healthcare. Like, this is not terribly shocking. So the thing is, it's a real paradigm shift in the sense of asking if there's a citizen in the States who needs money, and the UBI is an opportunity. The UBI, in pretty much every context I know of, it's not saying, hey, let that person sit at home and languish and, you know, just be a lazy jerk living off the dole, right? It's no, it gives you a subsistence level of income so that you, first of all, don't stress and can feed your kids and have healthcare, which if there's even enough money to do that. Or it's just the mentality shift of things like where there are government programs, well-intentioned, you know, maybe, but they're paying a lot of money and not working. Well, it's just a question of shifting the money from one place to the other. I'm being incredibly simplistic, which I realize. But I think most of all, the mentality in the States, a lot of it has to do with you know, the sort of like hardworking, you got to earn your money and don't take a handout, where as long as we keep thinking that UBI is a handout, you know, the narrative is just wrong, versus asking if, for instance, like here's a, you know, maybe not the question you asked, but I forget what most Americans pay depending on where you live and all that. Like, you know, to keep a person in prison, I forget what the price is these days. It's like $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year to keep one person in jail. And the American recidivism rate in jails and stuff is very high. If we were able to figure out how to take care of our prison problem and then allocate that money to the people who maybe could use the UBI, that's a solution. The other bigger solution, going back to the triple bottom line economics, like I mentioned, is when you actually measure things like depression and you think about the stress that people have when they don't have healthcare, for instance, and then the money it costs to keep those people healthy, meaning when they have depression, then you can actually start to put on a piece of paper, a spreadsheet saying, okay, if we were able to give this person a UBI of 10 or 20 grand, and it meant that they were able to have healthcare and they didn't go into depression, well, then we don't have to pay when they go into the emergency room, which are some of the highest costs in the States, you know, X amount per person on average to deal with that. And as that compounds and grows, because depression, for instance, has been growing as a pandemic type of issue, it becomes a spreadsheet issue. It's not a question of, is that person working or not enough and questioning their character. It's a spreadsheet issue of saying, if we gave these people $10,000 or $20,000, maybe you don't just give it to them in cash, you give it to them in some kind of supplement for medical care, for instance, then it means that ostensibly, at least, their healthcare is being taken care of. The cost item of the other depression related stuff would go down. So everything I'm saying is, first of all, foreign to a lot of people. It may be a paradigm shift. Actually implementing it is very hard. But, you know, I'm at the point where I talk daily, like we're probably going to talk about today, about machines may become conscious in 20 or 30 or 40 years, and yet we can't even consider, not you, Mark, but I mean, people can't consider the idea of, in the States, paying someone $10,000 or $20,000 in money to have universal health care, because that's, you know, an ideology that we don't necessarily share with Europe. Yet we're fine with depression going up and people not having the money and all the other complications that arise where we are right now. What we need to think about is the bigger societal ways to change and evolve, ask these machines to help us ask these questions about our values. And that way we can't be like, well, over here, let's put our, you know, brains into machines and Elon Musk is, wow, we're going to be able to, you know, read each other's thoughts and talk to each other's brains. Great. But let's live with GDP developed in 1944 and also not even think about, you know, actually implementing universal basic income. It's absurd to not bring up the societal infrastructure at the same level of technology, even to try to at least try to evolve it somewhat.
Let's move on with some of our remaining time here and talk about some other issues involving artificial intelligence and autonomous systems. We hear about privacy, potential malevolent use of artificial intelligence. What's your take on some of this? What do you think some of the other key issues are?
Sure, and let me, I don't mean to come off as doom and gloom. Like for me, doom and gloom is like robots will kill us, which is both kind of general, not really true at all, and people program robots. But to make it positive, here's some wonderful opportunities. With data and privacy issues, you know, what people tend to think about with the word privacy is preference, meaning you, Mark, might like to share your data, like Facebook posts, in one way, and a friend may share it differently. And that's great. That's preference. But one thing a lot of people don't think about is the nature that right now, as humans, we are tracked all the time, online and off. And I don't mean malevolent tracking. I just mean, you know, you are online and you're tracked by algorithms to help you know what you might want to buy. But we don't right now today universally have methodologies for all people to have essentially a personal, say, a data cloud that is tied to an identity source, whether it's a driver's license or a passport or something, that would allow an individual to have their terms and conditions about how they want their data shared, their values, as a data level or even algorithmic level mirror of themselves. And if people, your listeners, are thinking, why do I need that? Well, the answer is we've evolved beyond just an internet AOL sort of mindset of 10 years ago, where the internet is mainly kind of like an online bookstore where you're going to a website and there's no tracking. Being tracked at all times, especially before we get to virtual reality, when we're going to be, you know, potentially immersed at all times with our eyes and ears covered, means that even though we don't realize how our agency is being affected, once you get tracked by hundreds and hundreds of algorithms every day, even though each algorithm, you may not be aware it's actually affecting you. And affecting you might be something like you want one color of a sneaker versus another, right? That's not like a major value challenge. But the answer, first of all, is you don't know what it is. And second of all, by the time 10 or 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 of those algorithms in aggregate are tracking your data, which represents your identity, it does affect you. You don't know how. So if you're able to have what we call in the IEEE work we're doing, there's a standards working group called IEEE P7006, P as in Peter. It's this logic of creating for someone a personal data AI agent. And all that means is, in the same way you have a passport when you go to other countries, you have a personal data cloud that when algorithms track your data, you actually will know on a case-by-case basis what those algorithms are doing. Now, because you have so many of them reacting or touching on your data, it's not like the agent will tell you every time you're tracked. But what it can do is provide a sort of barrier where it's a symmetry with those things that track you. You can, in one sense, just know when they're tracking you, and you can set up these preferences, these terms and conditions. And if someone wants to track your data, and by the way, Mozilla has done a lot of this type of work with great ad tracking tools or ad blocking tools. It's just a reciprocal way of saying, hey, you want to use my data for X? I don't like my data to be used in that way. I'm happy if you want to use it in this way. This is why. So anyway, I'm very excited about this, and here's why. A couple of reasons. One, it means that people now are tracked from the outside in. That can be very beneficial, and people are kind of used to the values, or the value rather, that brings. But we have to be able to speak from the inside out at an algorithmic level. So this means people can have democratic choice and also express their values, things that you can't know just when you're being tracked. The other thing is, going back to the UBI thing, once your data is not a commodity as it is right now, especially Americans, if your data is tracked at all times and anyone can have access to it besides the people that generate it, because we can't access their data, then that means once you kind of close in and say, well, I'm the person now not owning the data, but I'm sort of deciding how the data is shared. Now that one individual becomes not a commodity with regards to their data, but they are actually managing the assets of their data. And that means, along with, won't be a lot of money by any means, certainly to start with, but eventually it could be at least a small revenue stream where, because you're the manager, as it were, of this asset of your data, it could actually be some form of either monetary exchange or some form of value exchange. So long answer there, except to say one thing I'm very excited about is this evolution of the data economy, where people can start to understand that they can create these channels for themselves where they can project their data and identity in the same way they're being tracked. They can also now track back, as it were.
Okay, one kind of final area here. How about the potential malevolent uses of AI? I mean, Vladimir Putin has been quoted as saying that whoever controls AI is going to control the world. In his recent book, Life 3.0, Max Tegmark paints some potential scenarios where the use of AI, maybe not even intentionally being malevolent, could turn malevolent. Where does the whole initiative stand on that?
I think we choose to focus not on the doom and gloom, but on saying once the level set of, for business and organizations, meaning policymakers and countries as well, say things like, you wouldn't put a car on the street these days that doesn't have a seatbelt, right? But 30 years ago, when seatbelts came first out, or however long ago it was, from my understanding, forget if it was like the ACLU or who it was that fought against it. Those are my personal freedoms. Now we're just used to it. Seatbelts keep our kids safe. In that same way, things like accountability. You don't build a system. This is what we advocate. Don't build a system where you can't tell someone what it does. And that's, by the way, good engineering in general, not because you know, you're bad because you're, we want you to be accountable to be blamed. No, you're accountable. Sure, there's compliance and safety issues, but it's also you build something and you trace back the algorithms and say, well, this worked really well. So the accountability and traceability is also about better business. So in that sense, you know, the malevolent stuff, I think a lot of it, the malevolent, you know, the killer robots and all that stuff, like the myth and the folklore and the movies, is easy to say, well, that's the malevolence. A lot of that is pure science fiction, or it's also just kind of like we should stop as a society talking about it so much, because eventually then you might kind of dream into existence what you're talking about, versus saying, hey, it's up to us. We're the humans programming these things. And in terms of the opportunity is not just look at the cool technology and what this technology can do, but to say, how can we imbue it with, not the actual machine can have our values literally, but how we can make the machines and the movements and the ways they respond to us manifest the values that we most want to mirror, not just in ourselves, but between each other. And in that sense, I think that the big danger for me is the risk of data, especially in the States. People don't have access to their data. Most, if not all, of AI is built on human data. So people not being at the center of their data, not really understanding how their data is exchanged, that's actually where we are today, and that has to be solved, period, especially with medical data. Medical data is life and death. And the other thing I mentioned, the danger is the economics, because, and this is, I already gave you the long answer about that, but triple bottom line, economics, on a very positive note, means nothing stops with building the glorious technology except potentially the pace. This is something, there's a myth or an ethos or a philosophy, especially in Silicon Valley, the whole idea of move fast and break things. From an innovation standpoint, depending on what you're inventing, I don't necessarily disagree with that. It's like the agile method for marketing, right? You got to have a fast kind of turnaround. I don't agree that that's the right way to move ahead when it deals with humans and their agency, their emotion, and their values. There's a potential for moving fast and breaking things, meaning you're either putting people in unsafe situations, or you're sort of saying, we don't think you're worth the time to really understand what your values are. And that's a message to the marketplace, especially from businesses. The smart organizations and governments are the ones that are going to say, hey, it's not about rushing to make bad legislation to stymie innovation, but we will prioritize the human well-being of our citizens and our consumers or our customers, so that we'll take more time to get to know your values, which is what we're advocating, and so that we build stuff for you. It's really attuned to who you are. It honors human rights, et cetera, but it's attuned to who you are. And secondly, if you're prioritizing human well-being, and people are allowed to do that, especially in the business world, they're given permission to go into their shareholders. This is my dream. I mentioned this maybe a minute ago, but at the end of a quarter, you're not just saying we made our fiscal numbers, but you're also saying we made our environmental numbers, and we made our numbers where we actually can demonstrate how we helped the humans that are part of our employees, our customers, the stakeholders that are involved with our business. That triple bottom line being honored means AI has a chance to flourish while humans flourish in the same time and same way. So that's where, rather than, I know you asked about the malevolent, because I kind of started off doom and gloom, I wanted to answer in a very positive way to end, which is triple bottom line, people at the center of their data. This is the real opportunity to make AI truly be for good.
John, thank you so much for your time and your good work in this area, both with your books and with IEEE.
Well, Mark, thank you for letting me to soapbox on a Friday afternoon. I really appreciate it.
It's a good thing, I suppose, that an organization of IEEE's global scope is undertaking this initiative. And even some governments are starting to act. The Emirate of Dubai, ever forward-looking, recently established a state ministry for artificial intelligence, and the government of India appointed an expert panel to advise it on AI policy and legislation. But even as this happens, the uncertainties seem to grow by the hour, and Western governments have at least overtly lagged behind as far as initiating any formal action to address the opportunities and risks. Meanwhile, the news stories on artificial intelligence and autonomous systems just keep on coming. Former Google CEO and current Alphabet executive chairman Eric Schmidt warned, for example, that China may soon overtake the U.S. in artificial intelligence. Elon Musk has announced that Tesla will introduce several new autopilot features to its electric vehicle line within the next few months. This comes as the U.S. Senate unanimously passed a bill to set national standards to allow driverless car development and proliferation. But perhaps the most stunning recent development has been the news that Saudi Arabia has granted citizenship to a humanoid robot named Sophia. Maybe bizarre is a better word for it, as Sophia apparently has more human rights than real Saudi women, many of whom are not amused by this development at all. Links to the IEEE Global Initiative webpage, along with those for all these stories, are available on the Seeking Delphi webpage for this podcast. Special thanks go to my guest John C. Havens and to you for joining me. My technical assistant is Mohammed Marouf. And until next time, I'm Mark Sackler.